welcome to Heavy Pod is Heavy Cast, episode 132.
Yay!
Cool fact of the number 132. 132 is the sixth Catalan number. I don't know what that means, but also, I'm looking at Wikipedia right now. If you take the sum of all two-digit numbers you can make from 132, you get 132. So 12, 13, 21, 23, 31, 32. If you add these up, you get 132. And 132 is the smallest number with this property.
Cool.
Which is also shared by 264, 396, and 35964. So, see you in episode 264. Goodbye.
See you in episode 35, what was it, 964?
Yep.
See you in like 10,000 years when the empire of man is collapsing and we bring you still shitty memes.
Did they ever progress the plotline of the emperor dying in 40k?
No, there is no 50k. Right now the only thing moving that storyline forward is the fucking role-playing games.
Yeah.
Not that good, so.
Don't the books carry the storyline?
Yeah, but I don't think they've released anything that actually moved the storyline forward. They're just filling in the blanks. You know, that's the beauty about Warhammer. You have infinite canvas to write stories about.
Yeah, like, I tried to get into the Warhammer books for a while, and I bought this, like, huge omnibus of, like, some, I don't fucking remember, some Space Marine chapter. Mm-hmm. It's just, like, constant fucking battles. Like, that's it.
You know, a lot of these tie-in series are just hack writers. There are some good writers that worked on some 40k stuff. But it's like, you know, if you have 100 40k books, then 95 of them are just absolute trash, and then you have, like, a few gems. But it's not worth sifting for it.
I'm trying to remember which one it was, so I just googled, like, Warhammer 40k Omnibus, and there's so many fucking
omnibus. Yeah, yeah.
Is the plural, like, of Omnibus Omnibi?
There actually isn't technically a plural of Omnibus, but it would be Omnibi, yes. I think so. I don't remember my declinations. What is this, like a Latin pop quiz? Fuck you. I'll ask Connie later.
Yeah.
She'd know.
Okay, but yeah, like, I mean, they did, like, 30k, and they did the whole, like, Horus Heresy plotline with that, right? So, I guess if they did, like, a post-Emperor death storyline, that would be, like, 50k?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they've been teasing at the return of, like, his clones, right? Like, because he has, like, several clones, and one of them is Horus, and they killed off some of them, and some of them were, like, disappeared into, like, the depths of grimdark space, but, like, they were saying, like, oh yeah, they're returning, so maybe they're gonna, like, replace the emperor and whatnot when he dies, but unclear.
Yeah, you know, when I enjoy stuff like this, you know, just ridiculously over the top stuff, and I do, I just read, like, one of the Malazan Book of the Fallen prequels. It's all about, we've spoken about this before, right? It's all about not giving yourself absolute freedom as a writer. You need to have these frames. And then the beauty of it, and good epic writers play within those frames and kind of mess around with them and twist them around and say, oh, you didn't expect it to do this. But actually, if you had thought about it, that's the way it works. And 40K is just so big.
Infinite canvas, like you said.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you can do literally anything you want. Like, if you can think of a weird 40k story that sounds like it's breaking the rules, it's probably already been written. And then if you put in, like, the fact that 20k is a thing and 30k is a thing.
I heard of 20k. What's the gist of 20k?
The 20k is, you know, like, the empire expanding, and it's the height of the emperor's power and forming the chapters and all that stuff. Like, it's like, you know, golden age, right? Mm-hmm. I'm sure some Warhammer fan is listening right now. It's like, no, you got it all wrong. We don't care, dude. We don't give a shit. Like, the thing I like about Warhammer, the setting, is that I can shit on it so much because no one hates it as much as Games Workshop hate it. They hate that franchise. There's no other way to explain how they've treated it. By the way, I'm an idiot. Omnibus. There aren't any plurals in Latin for it because it's the dative form of omnis. It's for all. So there's no real plural form there, although Wiktionary tells me it's usually omnibuses with one S or omnibuses with double S, and people use Omnibuy, but it's not standard.
Mm. Good to know.
In the grim, dark future, there's only Omnibuy.
Ah, the magical Omni school bus.
Do we want to talk about, like, music and shit? Or?
No.
We can keep talking about Warhammer. I have a lot of thoughts, like Warhammer Fantasy and why Fantasy is better than 40K and all sorts of stuff.
But 40K has Necrons, man.
But yeah, but Fantasy has Tomb Kings.
Yeah, but Necrons are stupider.
So what I want to say is that maybe Fantasy isn't better than 40K, but I feel like Games Workshop has mutilated it less.
Yeah.
So right now, like, the status of the fandom is doing better because it has been, you know, destroyed less by its parent.
Well, I feel like Fantasy is, like, it's less of an infinite canvas, so you can, like,
yeah, it's
fuck
contained.
It up less.
Yeah, yeah, it's basically like a parallel of 15th, 16th century Elf, right? So you gotta keep,
yeah,
you gotta stay within those borders, and in magic, obviously, and chaos and all that shit.
So it's more like the worst you can do is, like, be extremely generic high fantasy.
Well, which is what they're doing, right? They exchange all the blood and gold for unicorns and rainbows. Which is fine. It's just not fantasy. Not Warhammer fantasy.
Speaking of exchanging blood and gore for unicorns, apparently Apple Music has surpassed Spotify in the US.
If you say so, I don't, at this point, I don't know anymore. Fine. Like I said before we started recording, it's amazing how having an app you can actually use gets you users. I just hate the Spotify UI so much. It's so bad. Like, the whole mentality of, like, nested windows. Oh, it's a nightmare.
It's also, like, you know, when you actually pay your artists.
Yeah.
And don't have, like, scandals, I guess.
Yeah, and you don't hack your own databases to inflate your... Okay. I opened this article that you linked to, and there's, like, a video autoplaying.
Nice.
And the guy who's... No, there's no sound in their defense. And the guy who's, like, pitching the segment or whatever... Why can't I click pause? Thank you. He has a shirt that has really old pictures of The Rock. You know, like those cheesy ass photo shoots he used to do. And it says, "Know your role." And it's just, you know, The Rock's eyebrow glaring at me from within this article. It's amazing. So anyway, we spoke about this a few months ago, I think, because, yeah, in February, there was this report that Apple's growth was like 5% compared to Spotify's 2.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you just extrapolate those figures, you get why they surpassed them. And again, you know, you gotta take into account, this is in America where the iPhone, like, dominates the mobile market.
Yeah.
And you have that, like, people get Apple Music pre-installed on their phones and it syncs with iTunes and it syncs with their other Apple services. And again, I honestly believe that Apple Music is a superior music service as far as UI goes. I have a premium Apple Music user and not a premium Spotify user.
It seems like Spotify's recommendation system is better, but I think
that's
also something that comes with time and user base, and Apple can probably get there if they want to.
I mean, I do think that Spotify have some unique value propositions. Like, I do like the way that they, you know, playlists are at the front, discovery is at the front, and the algorithm works well. And yeah, I don't know the code, you know, it's probably just bigger data sets. But I wish there was an app that combined the power of Spotify's discovery tools and a proper UI. Like, that's why it frustrates me so much, because the service that I want to use is somewhere in there, in the 50th nested window, which the app has opened for me because I clicked on a fucking link. And I want to get to it. I want to use it, but the app just makes it so difficult. And there's also this thing where the Mac Spotify app program, whatever, takes over your shortcuts.
Nice.
Like, it disables a bunch of your shortcuts. It doesn't even use them, but it disables them. So,
nice.
Yeah, Apple, you know, that's their thing. They bring the smoothest experience out there. Their products they work better.
This podcast brought to you by Apple. Go to apple.com/heavypod is heavycast and sign up for literally nothing.
No, we won't. No, we won't give you anything.
No. Yeah.
We are just a mosquito on Apple's elbow.
That sounds annoying, man. Like, I don't want to. Oh, yeah, we're actually pissing them off. That's something you would notice.
Yeah. Yeah, no, we're like a micron particle or something.
That, I don't know.
I.
Speaking of micron particles, Dol Hamad announced a new album, finally.
That segue retroactively justifies my shitty metaphor.
In case you forgot about it, Dol Hamad is this weird Greek guy who makes extremely over-the-top space opera metal.
Hold on. Are you saying that Thanasis Lightbridge is not a credible and well-formed individual? Are you saying that he's over-the-top, Thanasis Lightbridge?
We previously talked about him when he did a Duel of Fates cover from the best Star Wars song from the best Star Wars movie.
Ooh, spicy. That's a spicy one.
I think it is the best Star Wars OST track from the worst Star Wars movie.
No, I mean, you're implying that there is such a thing as a good Star Wars movie, so I have to disagree.
Let's talk about The Last Jedi and the fan edits.
Let's not. I still haven't watched that fucking movie.
Really?
Yeah, I don't like Star Wars. I don't like the movies. I don't enjoy them.
Cultural capital, man.
Yeah, but no, I don't care. I've transcended cultural capital.
Yeah, but like claiming to have transcended cultural capital is just like an edgy way of saying, oh, I'm better than you.
I mean, yeah, but I own it at least. Back to the music.
Snap back to reality.
Oh my god. One of the tags, one of the Bandcamp tags on this album is needs more synths, and I really don't think this album will need more synths. Look, so there's a single called The Nova Temple. The album is called Cosmic Gods Episode 2 Astro Atlas. I fucking love this guy.
I like how Cosmic Gods Episode 1 was 6 years ago, and they haven't released anything since then.
Yeah.
But like, you know, like, It takes balls to label something episode one and then like not follow it up for 6 years.
Yeah, I agree.
And then actually follow it up 6 years later.
Yeah, it's like time two only actually releasing. So the track is exactly what you would expect. It doesn't need more synths. There's a ton of synths. They go really fast. There's like an orchestra choir thing. The artwork is insanely over the top.
The artwork is like Infinity War meets Star Wars.
Yeah, the robot thing, I think it's the bad guy. It actually reminds me of a bad guy from a comic book series I'm following. I'll talk about it at the end of this episode. It's pretty cool.
Okay.
Cool.
Yeah, this robot thing, like, looks like it's like torso is a planet surrounded by a metal ring, and its head is like a supernova with like infinity gems coming out of it, and it's holding a black hole in its hand, and then the other hand is holding an actual supernova, and it's fighting against like dreadnought class spaceships.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't see what the problem is.
Yeah, go fucking check this out. It's amazing. Dol Hamad is great. I'm super happy that this is happening again.
Yeah,
and
for
the website is lightbridge.tv.
Yeah,
of course.
And it's the website is a wild ride, by the way.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Speaking of wild rides, there's a new Soulfly song apparently.
Yeah.
Good. Soulfly's great.
Yeah, Soulfly, I like to classify them as serviceable. Like they do their job. They do they know what they're about. They've been about it for a long time and they just sound great and they do it really, really well. This new song, we only have it live, so and it's fan filmed, so it's not really indicative. But apparently they are going to release a new album called Ritual in October. The guy who produced it is Josh Wilbur. He's worked with Lamb of God and Gojira and a bunch of other bands. So you can imagine that the production will be chunky. As needed. He's worked with a ton of people, actually.
Yeah, bring me that As the Palaces Burn production.
The single worst thing Devin has ever done. So this guy, he's done a lot of stuff. Like, he's worked on Meta, Carl Bomb's Meta. He mixed that album. He's worked with Crowbar, Dillinger Escape Plan, like I said, Gojira, Hatebreed, Korn.
Lamb of God album.
Remind Wrath. Me which one you think it is, Wrath?
Yeah. I think it's Wrath, yeah. Let's do a album. Deep dive on Lamb of God.
Lamb of God deep dive the podcast.
He's done the Tenacious D album. Oh, he's worked on The Sin and the Sentence.
Oh, sweet. Yeah, he did a really good work. He did really
production,
good work,
engineering, though. Mastering.
Yeah. Psalm 41. Like, this guy's been around, so okay. I think they're in good
hands.
No,
like, Sin and Sentence sells it for me. That album sounds amazing.
Yeah, that album is great. And again, like I said, it has that full sound, right? Everything's very pronounced, very present. So that's what Soulfly need. You know, he also did Iron Show, dude, on his Iron Show.
Nice.
You also like that album.
That album is super underrated. Yeah, go check out underrated. Iron Shore by Oni. They have, instead of a... I don't remember if it was instead of a bass player, but instead of a synth player, sorry, yeah, they have a xylophone player.
Yeah.
It's really cool. It totally works. Speaking of Trivium, by the way, quick aside. You know how we talked about Weezer covering Africa?
Yeah.
Matt Heafy covered Heafy, Africa. Yeah. he's doing this thing where he's taking like people who donate to him above a certain amount get to like request him to cover a song.
Yeah.
He did Britney's One More Time and he did Toto's Africa, and his singing of Toto's Africa, he actually nails the notes, unlike like Weezer or Toto.
Yep.
Yeah. Interesting to note. It's not like a super amazing cover. He just like, you know, gets a guitar and like sings on top of it, but hey, he actually is able to sing. So yeah.
Cool.
Speaking of being actually able to sing, this segue has nothing to do with singing, but
the singer's pretty good.
Yeah, they're good, but like not a singer. Yes. There's a new Black Fast song. It's Black and Fast, so
we spoke about these guys a few weeks ago when they released, I think that was the first single from their upcoming album. Just really, really solid modern thrash metal, so we kind of wanted to remind you that these guys exist. The new track is called Husk, and like I can't describe separate tracks on the album because it's thrash. Come on, it all sounds the same. But it sounds the same in a good way. Like it works. They're good players. The vocalist does a really good job, and it's interesting. Like it has a cool solo. It has cool riffs. It just does what you want good modern thrash to do. And you know, going back to Dolomad, it's kind of the same thing, you know, unapologetic about what they do, right? Where he embraces like the over the top space opera kind of shtick, they're all about this kind of aggressive thrash vibe. You see it in the artwork, you see it in the singing style and in the lyrics and in the playing. And if this is what you're looking for, then pay attention to this album. You won't be disappointed.
So, by the way, I forgot to mention, there's a new Aborted track.
Oh, yeah.
It's called Squalor Opera. It's really good. I mean, Aborted is like Soulfly in that like they're just like super consistent and super solid all the time. Yeah. But I feel like this song stands out a bit more to me than some of their recent output. Sorry, go ahead.
I'm not the biggest Aborted fan, you know, I appreciate them from a distance, it's not really my kind of music. But as you said, this one sounds a bit more energetic, a bit more fresh.
They have like some leads going that kind of give it a little bit more character.
Yeah, and the videos, whatever, it's just them playing. But again, they've been around, they know the right people, they have the right amounts of money, so things look professional and well done. And yeah, if you like Aborted, then there's a new album coming out, Television, September 21st. Wow, so many great releases this year. God.
So the thing, I think one reason this song kind of stands out is A, it has like a kind of a chorus-y riff that they repeat that kind of, they don't always do that. So it kind of, you know, is a bit more memorable. And it has a like clean break with like, you know, kind of break song and... what am I saying? Like, Mendel just plays the guitar a little bit, and that kind of breaks the song up. And then they come in with, like, a strong, like, blast beat fast thing with leads. And that, like, there's a bit more structure to this song than some of their output, I think, which is cool.
Yeah, I agree.
Like, I've listened to, like, every album of theirs since, like, man, since the genre shift, basically. And yeah, it's good.
Cool.
There's a new Unearthed track, but it's bad, so we don't care.
Yeah, we're going to gloss over that one.
There's a new 6 Feet Under album, and it's bad, so we don't care.
It's super bad.
There's a new Between the Buried and Me song. I haven't even listened to it.
I don't bother. Like, people are talking about this second part as if, oh, this makes it make sense, the splitting of the albums. It's not as bad as the first part. That's all I got for you. It's just fine. Whatever. It's one of those bands that are just, we spoke about this, you know, when do you get off? Like, when do you stop caring about a band? And after, when Parallax 1 was whatever, I was like, okay, yeah, Great Mr. X was great, so I'm going to stick around. But then Parallax 2 was just, ugh. Stop following, stop giving them modern cursory listens, and it just doesn't seem like it's worth it.
So, I know you hate things, so you're not into Game of Thrones, but I just wanted to read this headline to you.
I've seen this.
We can just mention the headline and move on. Game of Thrones' Hodor talks World of Warcraft with members of Korn and more in new video.
Yeah. You remember the thing with Megadeth?
Yeah.
Yeah, so maybe it's a thing now. This guy, people found out he's into metal, and now PR is probably emailing like 50 times a day. Oh, well, shitty band from the Bay Area who played the exact same riff that Metallica played 20 years ago. They like Game of Thrones. Yeah, what about the Lannisters? And then they hook up with this guy, and he talks to them about World of Warcraft for some reason. I'm a bit bitter. I don't know if you've noticed.
No.
This clickbaity title just gets me so annoyed.
I've been into Aborted since the Archaic Abattoir. I haven't listened to, like, I've only cursorily listened to their first three albums. So the thing about Aborted was, just like Cattle Decapitation and like several other bands, they used to be like a lot more grindy on the death grind side, and then they transitioned into modern death metal. Yeah. Seeing that there's money there and that's popular with Metal Sucks. Like, that was a thing. And they've been extremely successful as a result. And Cattle Decapitation haven't, like, followed up as much, whereas Aborted have, like, consistently made an album every 2 years.
And the music is actually good and consistent. So.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, speaking of, like, changing genres and improving over time, I have a hot take topic to discuss, and Eden can take this to a bullshit philosophy discussion direction as well.
Yeah.
And
set us up.
The hot take is that newer stuff is just kind of better.
Yeah.
And here is the argument. So when did this come up? We were talking about, let me talk about the setup. The setup was Eden just messaged me saying, the song on the new Alkaloid album, the Morbid Angel one.
As decreed by laws unwritten.
Yeah. So the context here is that ever since Omnivium, I think, or maybe even Cosmogenesis, the Obscura crowd, a.k.a. Obscura, Chris Minzner, Hannes Grossman, Alkaloid, all their projects, they have done this thing where they do an homage to Morbid Angel's Where the Slime Live. Off which album? I forget. The famous one. So basically, it's from the one with the green and purple cover. I forget the name of the album.
Keep going.
Anyway, so the gist is that they do this like slow
domination.
Isn't that the Pantera song? Anyway,
no, that's the Morbid.
Yeah, I know. It is domination. So okay. So basically, they do this song where it's like slow and like fast, slow guitars, fast double bass, low vocals, and then like a two-step feel.
Yeah.
And like that's a, you know, very classic Morbid Angel song. And on Omnivium, it was Ocean Gateways. On Alkaloids, it was Cthulhu.
Yeah.
Right? On Acheresis, it was... Which one was it? Fuck. The Monist. On Alkaloid 2, it's As Decreed by Laws Unwritten. On Hannes' albums, there's one as well, on the solo albums. And on the new Obscure album, it's the fourth track. I forget its name. It has a long name. Anyway, so the point is that they've been doing this, right? And I was like, hey, dude, yeah, just listen to the original Morbid Angel song to Eden when he was talking about liking As Decreed by Laws Unwritten. But then Eden was like, yeah, but I just can't listen to Morbid Angel. And I was like, well, yeah, because like the newer stuff is just better, which could be a pretty controversial statement because, like, you know, Morbid Angel are like originators. They're respected. They've made great albums like Illa Divinum Insanus.
I missed that one. It took me a second.
Yeah, so, but the thing is, I also went back to this conversation where, like, my wife, she's, like, super into Avenged Sevenfold, right? And, like, whenever she plays me, like, a cool song from them, from their latest albums, I'm like, dude, this is basically Metallica.
Yeah.
It's like, they really do this thing where, you know, Metallica have the, like, extended instrumental interludes in, like, especially in the Justice / Master of Puppets era.
Right? Yeah.
And then I just play some Metallica to her to like convince her, right? And it just sounds bad compared to it. Like if you're just listening to that aspect, right? The production is not as modern and it's kind of basic. And but I'm not going to talk about production here, right? Production is just a, you know, technical limitation. I want to talk more about the songwriting.
Yeah.
And the songwriting is just more basic. Like the Metallica stuff is just kind of more repetitive. Like the harmonies are less exploratory. The kind of progressive sections are less drawn out in a like, and I don't mean drawn out in a bad sense here, right? Because the whole point of like an instrumental break is to draw it out, right? Mm-hmm. So the idea is that it's just newer stuff can be inherently better because it has the hindsight to be able to build on what came before. Because like Metallica, when they were doing this kind of stuff, they were treading new ground, right? So basically they it's almost like everything is low-hanging fruit because, like, no one has picked anything, right?
Yeah.
So you don't need to reach for the higher things, and you don't even necessarily know there's fruit higher up in the tree, right? So you just, like, grab the fruit.
I think that that's the point that immediately grabbed me when I started thinking about this. It's a question of feedback, right? Like, mm-hmm. when Metallica wrote Kill 'Em All, they got amazing feedback from the fans, so there was really no reason for them to think we need more than this, right?
Yeah.
They basically said, oh, breaking this new ground is enough. We don't need to, you know, add another note here or write this in a more complicated way. Maybe the opposite is true, right? Like, we have something good going on here, don't fuck with it. Or if you want to be a bit less of a cynic, say, it's good because it's minimal. Right? That's why it broke ground. It's good because it, like, stripped, in the case of Metallica for sure, like, it stripped down music from its epic and classical influences and made something very direct, very brutal, very angry, very simple. That was, you know, it echoed with a certain crowd. But if you expand the discussion a bit, you come to this point where, you know, it's like a drug. Right, it's like doing a drug. You constantly need more and more hits. The amount of substance that you consumed when you started off just doesn't do it anymore for you. So you gotta drink more, right? You gotta drink two shots now to get drunk, and you develop a tolerance. The thing is, the old bands, you know, they run out of steam because there's only so many shots you can order, right? Like, you keep building and building and adding, and you get the Black Album, and okay, that's not enough, right? We did the Black Album, but people want more from us, and then they falter. But newer bands, they start off from where the older bands fell, right?
Yeah. If they're good. They have hindsight.
Yeah, exactly. But it's not just hindsight in the sense of, you know, oh, this is what they did, this is where they went wrong. They just, their entry point is just that much higher on the scale. Like, a dose of Avenged Sevenfold in the late 90s is worth more than a dose of Metallica in the late 90s, no matter what they write. Because Avenged Sevenfold is just fresh in people's ears, right? It doesn't matter if they make music that is similar, they still have their differences. And people aren't used, you know, there's the whole James Hetfield meme with the yeah and all that stuff. Where does that come from? That comes from people being tired of his shtick, right? They've heard this shtick for like 30 years, just enough. We don't want to hear it again. So when this new guy comes along, what's his name? M. Shadows or whatever?
Yeah.
He comes along. Doesn't matter if it's similar, it's different. He has his own mannerisms. He has his own style. So even if they start off from where Metallica left, they still, you know, they get more on their return, right? They get, sorry, they less diminishing returns. They get more for their buck.
Yep. Also, there's like inherently as a new band to be able to kind of, you know, carve your own name. You can't just do like what Metallica did, right? You have to add something else to it. You have to, you know, you have to add more layers of harmonies. You have to add like faster riffing. You have to add like longer songs. You have to add like, or I don't know, screaming different vocals. Like you just kind of have to keep building inherently.
It can also be stuff that's not musical, right? You can shake up the aesthetic, right? Yeah. You can take stage names or write about stuff that Metallica never wrote about. It can be in the delivery, like you can use interesting ways of interacting with your fans, mm-hmm. but you need to, as you said, you need to add on to this thing. And I think another aspect that I want to add here is also, usually we're used to thinking of nostalgia as something that works in the favor of the object towards which we feel nostalgic. Mm-hmm. Like if you feel nostalgic towards a certain type of food, it doesn't matter if it's actually disgusting, you'll think it tastes well because it reminds you of your childhood, right? But it's also a detriment. It's also like a burden, right? Because when Avenged Sevenfold come to record their new album, their first album, right? They're free. No one knows who they are.
Yeah.
They don't have a label. They don't have a producer. They don't have expectations. They don't have fans, you know, beyond their dads and their moms and their cousins or whatever, their friends from high school. They can just do whatever the fuck they want. They can fuck up, right? There are plenty of bands, contrary to what we've focused on the podcast so far, who have terrible debut albums and great albums after. But they could fuck up on that first album and no one would say anything. Oh yeah, of course, nobody from Nowheresville fucked up. But when Metallica fucked up for one album, it starts a whole spiral.
Yep.
Right? And then you get people saying, oh, Metallica are shit. And you know, you're Lars or James or whatever, you read people saying Metallica, and you're like, oh yeah, you don't like this? Well, fuck you. We're gonna make this harder, right? We're gonna keep going down that path. Like, if you think that doesn't play a role in musicians' lives and how they choose to make music, then you don't know how this works, right? That definitely plays a role. So there's a lot of contrarianism and a lot of weight and expectations and pressures, sometimes financial pressures as well, right? Like, loans you took for previous albums and record deals you're obliged to, and when you're a new band you're free of all of that. You're free to work as you'd like.
Yep. So to be clear, it's not that something is going to be better just by the virtue of being new, right? Like have all the time, you have bands that are newer than older ones, but they're worse because, like, you know, newness inherently isn't a good thing. Good thing here is, like, the reason new good things are better is because the good things that build on the old things are inherently better.
So that's another thing I wanted to bring in here, and I totally think that this is like the first part of the discussion where we set up the idea and then we'll start tearing it down, because I do think there's a lot of criticism to be said about this. But keeping on with the building for a second, it's interesting to consider, you know, music as something that's constructed. That's something that people don't really like to do. We've spoken about this a million times, especially when we were starting out with the podcast. You know, this whole idea of music being intermediate, like there's no mediation between the genius and his art. It's not a careful construction. It's like a wellspring, right? A fountainhead, if you will. That's an Ayn Rand reference. But actually, it goes back to Judaism. By the way, it's interesting. It's one of the types of students. And the highest type is the fountainhead, because knowledge kind of springs out of them. Mm-hmm. And this is how people see music. But that's really not the case. And when you start to look at new bands and how they work, and you start questioning new artists, you see that it's very, in certain cases, it's a conscious effort. I'm sure you can attest to this. Like, I've spoken to you several times and said, oh yeah, this track is totally a bit of this, a bit of that. Scaffolding in between, that's my stuff and my take on things, but totally like conscious, oh, I am now paying homage to Morbid Angel. I am now paying homage to Obscure. Like, and that does something to new music, right? It gives you a wealth of experience that these people didn't have. Like Metallica, who Metallica couldn't look to anyone.
Yeah.
Right? Or you know what? Let's move away from Metallica. Venom. Right?
Mm-hmm.
When Venom were making their music and pioneering black metal, like, there was nowhere to look. Or Death. Or Black Sabbath, you know? So obviously, they looked across genres. And that's where you start to get, you know, influences of blues and jazz and blah, blah, blah. But they still didn't have someone who did those influences in quite the same way. So that's another piece of the puzzle here, I think. The whole idea of construction, how when you're new in an established genre, you have a toolbox, right?
Yeah.
And if we bring in production back for a second, even though it's like a technicality, and I agree with that, you also get technical tools. Like, you know how to make drums sound better. Because 50,000 producers smashed their head against the wall of how to get good drum sound in a room. Right?
Yep.
It just did. And there's like accepted wisdom that was inherited. You didn't do anything for it. Like, you didn't study sound. But your producer is much more technically capable than the people who came before him.
And that actually influences the songwriting as well. Because
yeah,
producers
can
will
do
go
more.
And... No, but yeah, that, but also producers will go and say, look, you added this riff here, or added this harmony on this lead here, but it's already, like, the sound here is going to be pretty full because you're having, like, a blast beat going on, and you're also singing on top of it. So maybe let's pull this harmony back. Let's not use this here because yeah, it's going to be too busy, and we can use it elsewhere in this song. So that also, like, informs that
yeah,
kind of growing base of knowledge informs the songwriting as well.
And if you go back, like, even further, we can talk about the tools that you use to make the music, like 8-string guitars.
Yeah.
Right? You have 8-string guitars now. That's the thing that wasn't around. Like, when was the first 8-string guitar? 15 years ago? 20 years ago? I mean, like, commercially, not like
commercially,
experimental.
Like, 10 years ago?
10 years ago, right? That gives you more range. You can write new things. Like, djent wouldn't exist without this tech. We can talk about triggering drums. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you want to write this insanely fast blast beat, but you know that you technically can't hit as strong on every one of those hits.
It's just going to sound bad, right? So
yeah,
you wanna...
so 30 years ago, you're going to chuck that. Today, you're just going to trigger it. Quantizing, recording note by note, all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've said on the podcast several times, those are not bad things. They allow people to make music that they couldn't
20
years ago.
Every band that you... love and listen to most likely uses quantizing on the guitars. Obscura uses quantizing on the guitars. Every tech death band, like, that's the thing.
Yeah,
if you think quantizing is any less common than, like, drum triggering, then you're wrong.
Oh, and by the way, we won't address the meme directly because the guy lives next to me and I'm worried he'd like assassinate me, but everyone triggers their drums. Everyone fucking
yeah,
triggers the drums. Unless you're like,
even
playing...
if the band thinks they don't trigger the drums, the producer will trigger the drums
yeah,
in post.
Like, unless you're playing like Lynyrd Skynyrd or something super simple, you're fucking triggering those drums. Because why not? Why not sound better
because
when you can?
It sounds better, yeah.
Yeah. So looping back, it's, you know, maybe expanding the conversation even further. We had the tools and we had building on experience and we had, you know, learning from mistakes, but also what you can afford when you know that the genre you're working in exists, right? So, like, a mediocre thrash band, or not mediocre, but not entirely unique, they can carve out a niche in their scene today because mm-hmm, they know the scene exists. People know what they're doing. But when you're first, right, it's scary.
Yeah.
It's fuck. You're gonna take risks because you have to. Because you have to carve out that niche, but maybe those risks make you sound not as, like, you put in the solo to sound weird because you knew that otherwise no one would listen to your album because you'd mm-hmm, be just another, you know, dime a dozen band. It drives you to do things that kind of being alone, being afraid, doing something new. It puts all sorts of pressures on you. Like, the best example I can think of is Dream Theater. 100% some of the stuff that's on the first albums is totally there to make Dream Theater sound different than a million other pop rock bands that were around the early 90s, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, some stuff on the first albums, even I love those albums. I fucking love them. Some of my favorite pieces of music ever. Some of the stuff on there is like, guys, you really didn't need this signature change here. You just did it to sound like Dream Theater, which is fine. We can argue on the merit of that. But when you're already working within an established scene, there's just so much less pressure.
Yep.
And again, I have a million things to criticize on this, but we're setting up the idea now, so we'll continue. We'll break it down in a bit.
All right. Well, let's move to the breakdown.
Yeah. I feel like there's something else that I'm not... Okay, maybe it'll come to me later. Let's move on.
Yeah, I mean, we could always circle back around.
Yeah, for sure.
So, I mean, the inherently obvious thing is that more isn't necessarily better.
Yeah.
Right? So yeah. Just because you're adding more harmonies, longer sections, whatever, that doesn't necessarily mean that your music is going to be better. So while we do say that, you know, bands that come later have to add more, that doesn't always mean that they're going to be inherently better because they just added more, right? It's all about kind of how everything works in the framework, and like this doesn't necessarily make the old stuff lose value by comparison.
Yeah. And I think also, you know, the inherent criticism is you can't, like you and I, we can't really have this discussion because nostalgia colors every opinion that we have. Like it's impossible to break out of that. There's no authentic love of music, right? No one objectively likes music. We all have our own baggage. So when I hear something new, and I say, yeah, this is amazing. I actually have to be aware of how that plays into my nostalgia because new bands will do that, right? They'll drop hints of solos from famous work and they'll do riffs and lyrical callouts. And a lot of the reason that you're going to love that stuff is because, oh, I recognize this. I like really can't stress enough. People don't bring this up, enough, I feel, in the metal journalism community. Music is a pattern. Right? And a lot of the kick that we get out of music is recognizing patterns. Yep. Because it speaks to one of the most basic functions of our brain. Right? Recognizing repetition and recognizing similarities. A lot of that time that you get the rush is because you already know a track or you know something that it references. Right? Yep. So it's impossible to disconnect our love of quote-unquote new music and the way in which it references, speaks to, and relies on the old stuff. So saying that it's better might just be missing the point that it's not that it's better. It's just, it's been 20 years since you heard that solo. And hearing it now kind of makes you tear up, you know? I can, you know, a lot of why I loved Vector is that up until that album came out, I kind of fell out of my thrash and I didn't listen to Metallica for ages. And suddenly I heard these solos. I was like, oh man, yes. I remember why I like this genre. Is that because Vector is amazing? Well, they are amazing, but it's also because they work within the context of that music that I know. And someone who never listened to thrash, I don't think they like Vector.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's about, you know, the kind of notion of deconstructing / reconstructing the genre, right? And you need to have some frame of reference to do that.
Yeah, for sure. And I think... it's also a matter of just the sheer amount of music that's releasing today in comparison to how things were in the 80s. The 70s. I'll just start off by saying that kind of thing, that gap is kind of overblown. A ton of music was also being released in the 70s and the 80s. But it was definitely not as approachable as it is today. So maybe it's not that new is inherently better, but we just have better chances at hearing the good stuff that's being released today. Like, I'm sure there are 100 bands that did Metallica better than Metallica in the 80s, but they're lost to time, right? They never took off. They never got signed. They never got released. And we don't know what that music is. Maybe old is better, but we're missing so much of old, that new stuff just shines through, all the most, you know, strongly. So that's another thing to take into account here. And the last thing I want to say to kind of break this thing is the whole appeal of retro movements, right? Sometimes better is going back to how things were and just doing it unapologetically, right? Yeah. So I don't know. I know you don't like the movement, but the traditional heavy metal revival, and you know, some bands go to the extreme, like, Lunar Shadow, right? Those guys who took the production as well. and their whole appeal is, hey, remember when metal sounded like this? It can again, right? It can sound like this again, and it's pure nostalgia. Or stuff that's less flagrant, less blatant, you know, like bands, you know, like Aborted almost, right? This is the thing. You heard an Aborted album 20 years ago. This is pretty much the same. Why change? You love this thing. And we're just going to keep doing it well. We're going to sound well. We're going to compose well. We're going to be well produced. We're going to just give you what you want. So maybe there's another layer here too. Maybe we can say that it's more new is better when it communicates with the past in interesting ways. When it does interesting things with what came before. Mm-hmm. I don't know, just throwing it out there as a midway in this discussion.
No, yeah, I think that makes sense. Because, I mean, new is kind of contextualized by the old, like we said earlier, right?
Yeah. But the thing I want to, you know, I'm just babbling here. I've been thinking about this ever since you brought it up. You know, I used to be very bad at this. Like, people would say, oh, I don't like Iron Maiden. And I would say, you have to at least appreciate them, right? Because they mm-hmm. were so important and they were so, you know, crucial for the development. And that's all true. But people don't owe bands anything. Like, yeah. People are allowed not to like Metallica. I'm talking about metalheads. Obviously, someone who doesn't like metal won't like Metallica. I'm talking about, like, a metalhead that listens to Vector and Blackfast and whatever other modern thrash is out there. And he says, yeah, Metallica are bad. That's fine. They don't owe Metallica anything because Metallica, like, founded the genre. Or Iron Maiden or Blind Guardian or Dream Theater or Death or Venom or any other of these progenitor bands. Appreciation of history and like liking the music is completely unrelated.
Yep.
So that's just another thought I had that I wanted to throw out there.
Yeah, and I think it takes like a different kind of mentality to appreciate the historic value. I don't think it's something that everyone is interested in doing.
Yeah.
I think more people should be interested in doing it because I think it's fascinating and like, you know, as historians always say, you know, history repeats itself. No, that's bullshit. basically, like, you know, understanding historical context of something, if you're really into it, is a good thing in general because it lets you...
It's like one of my professors said. Like, he's, you know, he's tenured. He's been studying and teaching for 30 years. And people ask him, why? Why should I study history? And he really doesn't like the whole, oh, we should know the past to learn about the future, blah, 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 blah. He just says... Look, history makes the world more beautiful because it gives you a really wide network of symbols and connections. And everyday stuff suddenly becomes, well, to steal a line from, what's his name? Saffron Foy, like illuminated in the light of the past, right? Mm-hmm. Like that street corner is not just a street corner if you know that that's where, I don't know, the first union in your town was founded, or that hillside is not just a hillside if you know that once it hosted the fair of all the villages, whatever. It injects everything with more meaning, and we like meaning. Our brains like these kind of connections. So if when you look at history historically, suddenly you become better at, you know, figuring out all these connections and all these influences. And it's just cool. It's cool to nerd out about. It sounds better. It gives you context. So I really like doing that. And I think a lot of music journalists like to do that, but they don't do it enough.
Yep.
Yeah. This is interesting. All right. Like, I feel like this is a topic that's been accompanying me for years, and I haven't really thought about it. It's a constant... pressure, right? That the past.
Yeah.
Like, I should listen to the greats. I haven't listened to the greats in a while. Yeah, it's interesting.
And also, it's like a hard thing to kind of balance too, because like, there's things good about old stuff, there's things about good about new stuff, and like, you're constantly bombarded by new stuff. But yeah. You also maybe want to value old stuff to some extent, but it's also like harder to get into it. Like, we've all talked about these things, right? And it feels like this constant struggle, I think. And it's interesting to kind of try to internalize that, externalize that.
Yeah, I think at the outset, like, to summarize what I want to say is, it would disappoint me if what someone took from this discussion is this kind of liberal, and I'm talking about the original definition of liberal, like the 19th century liberal.
Classical liberal.
Yeah. If they would take out this idea of, you know, the trend of history is going towards better, like things are improving over time, and as we move along, music just gets better and blah, blah. That's not what we're saying. It's not that objectively the quality of the music can be measured against old music and it's 0.5, it has better fucking particles that make it sound better. But the context of it, how it meets us, what it does, the possibilities that it has, the ideas, the instruments, the context, yeah, keeps pushing music forward in many, many ways. And makes it on one side more appealing because it's fresh. On the other, a bit less substantial at times, a bit less emotionally impactful. Like, I've been walking around with Awake for 15 years. I don't think, like, 2% of the albums that I've heard in the last 5 years I'll be listening to in 15 years.
Yep.
That's it.
Good talk.
Yeah. Cool people time?
Yeah, cool people time.
Yeah. What was I gonna... Oh, comic book.
Yeah, comic book. Dollamod.
There's a guy called... Oh, fuck. Of course, I forgot his name. The artist is called Ryan Brown. That guy's insane. That's the guy who does God Hates Astronauts, which is a really quirky, over-the-top, weird parody of comics. It's super, like, rude in a, you know, like an eighth grader kind of sense. It's really, really good. And Charles Soule, he wrote Letter 44. And he wrote Daredevil and She-Hulk and Death of Wolverine and some Star Wars stuff for Marvel. But Letter 44 is the best thing he did. I think you'd like it. It's like this really cool sci-fi thing, which kind of reminds me in some ways of, Peter Watts, like in the premise. Like, aliens show up, we can't communicate with them. It's pretty obvious they're building a weapon somewhere in the solar system. It's pretty interesting. It has a different vibe. It's not horror, but it's interesting. So these guys, Charles Soule and Ryan Brown, who sound completely at odds with each other as far as style go, they're collaborating on this thing called Curse Words. And it's basically what God Hates Astronauts did for fantasy. So the premise is that there's another plane called the Whole World, so like H-O-L-E without a W, and there's this all-powerful entity there called Sizaji, and that's the guy who looks like the villain from Dollamod's artwork, and he has 9 wizards, like the most powerful wizards, and chief amongst them is Wizard with an O. And one day he sends Wizard to destroy the Earth. Why? Because fuck it. Like, he needs it for his Infinity Gauntlet or whatever. But Wizard comes here and discovers that this place is pretty cool. So he betrays Sizaji. I'm pretty sure they made it. His name is how to pronounce as possible on purpose. and he sticks around. And he discovers that, you know, being severed with that guy costs him his magic. But if he harvests humanity's faith in things, he can get some of his magic back. Now, what kind of wizard is he? He's like when you're level 40 in D&D. He's like, he can change anything. And then you take Ryan Brown.
The epic level handbook is ridiculously overpowered.
Yeah, so he could like spin those characters on one finger, right? Like he can destroy the universe, whatever. But it saps his power. So some of the jokes, like his power level is indicated by the length of his beard. Whenever he casts magic, his beard becomes shorter. There's like an Interpol agent who becomes obsessed with him and he turns him into a chair at some point so he can sit on his face.
This sounds like Discworld at times.
Yeah, it has like a Discworld vibe, but it's like Discworld times 100 as far as how ridiculous it is. And Ryan Brown is such a talented artist. He has such a touch for little Easter eggs and funny stuff. So if you like parody, you like over-the-top stuff, and you like fantasy, pick up these books. They're actually well-written. Like, they introduced other characters in there, and they're super hilarious. And check it out. It's a good comic book. I think it's on Image.
What was it called?
Curse Words.
Curse Words. Okay. Because he has a bunch of things, right?
Yeah, he has a ton of things. He's really prolific.
Okay. So I saw the first Purge. I don't know if I've ever talked about the Purge movies on the cast before.
I think I distinctly remember you mentioning them, yeah.
Okay, so so the first Purge movie, not the movie called The First Purge, but the first movie in the series,
yeah,
was a lame home invasion movie with a really cool premise, right? And if you're somehow unfamiliar, right, the premise of the Purge movies is that, like, on one day every year for 12 hours, they make, like, all crime legal so that people, like, let out their aggression or whatever, right?
Yeah.
Like, Sounds kind of dumb, right? The first movie was basically like this rich white family, like they hole up in their house during the purge, but mm-hmm. then like people try to break in, and that's kind of the premise there. So then they did the second one, right? And the second one was actually pretty interesting. Like, it had some pretty good action. I think Frank Grillo, the guy who plays the Punisher, was the main character in that. Yeah. And it was actually like a pretty sweet movie. Yeah, he was the main character. And then in that movie, they started to like go in on this premise of like, so maybe the Purge is actually like not just this thing where, you know, you get to do whatever you want, but it's actually a way for the upper class to oppress the lower class, right? Basically, rich people, because obviously when it comes time for Purge, rich people are going to have more resources than poor people to purge with, right? So the second one kind of ended on this like twist of basically like rich people using the Purge to like capture poor people, and like they have death squads, and then they like make these people fight to the death or something like that. So it was kind of like a you know, they're just like fucking around.
Blood sport.
And like they introduced this notion of like a resistance, right? And the third movie like went really hard on that. And the third movie wasn't as good as the second one, but the idea was that there's this politician, this lady, and like she was this very obvious like Hillary analog, right?
yeah.
She's running a campaign on the like abolishing the Purge, right? And the government, the party in charge of the country in these movies is called the New Founding Fathers of America, which mm-hmm.
yeah,
very like on the nose. They're trying to like kill her. They're using the Purge to take her out. And that was kind of the premise. And it was like even more obviously political. So the first Purge, the fourth movie,
the prequel.
Yes. Shows like how it all started. Right. And the premise is that they identify Staten Island as like one area to try out this social experiment. They don't call it the Purge at first, right? They call it just a social experiment where they're going to legalize all crime to see if, you know, this idea works. And it still sounds like pretty over the top, right? But then like they start kind of tying it to analogs of real life events. Mm-hmm. And then it becomes like too real. And the basically like, the only white people in the movie are the politicians and the villains.
Oh,
and it's pretty clear that they chose this area and the projects because like there's poor people there. And so spoilers later throughout the movie, it comes out that basically they're trying to first purge, but like nobody's actually killing anyone. Nobody's doing anything. They basically throw a rave. And there's this like one psycho criminal that they let loose in there, and that like, he kills one guy, but otherwise everybody just like partying and doing drugs and shit, right?
Yeah.
Then the government intervenes and they send in like militia, not militia, sorry, like PMCs, under like the disguise of like actual purgers to start killing people because like they realize that it's not actually working, and they're basically like they, you know, create this narrative of, oh, this is what the people wanted. See, like, everybody purged. This is working. And, yeah. So, it's, like, pretty, the way they kind the way they kind of tie this to, like, fake news and fascism and abuse of authority and stuff like that is, like, way too real. so, in that aspect, it was pretty cool. Additionally, the character drama itself was serviceable. The action scenes were actually really good, and the tension was really good. So the majority of the movie is like waiting for things to happen in that, like, because like people aren't purging at first, right? So it's this scary atmosphere of like you don't trust anyone, what's going on, what's where, and is like, is something going to happen? And slowly builds this tension. At the very end, once they send in the PMCs, the action just goes balls to the walls. So there's two really cool action sequences. One of them is this like neighborhood establishment where like there's these three old guys that they show in the beginning of the movie. They're like the, you know, staple of the neighborhood, right? They're like, everybody knows them. They're the pillar of the community. And the PMC goes, surrounds this, and they're like shooting at it, right? And the main character in this movie is actually a gang leader. Like, he's a drug dealer, drug lord. And like, he's kind of a bad guy, obviously. But when he realizes what's going on, he decides to protect the community. And like, because like, you know, the whole notion of like the drug lords kind of trying to be like a member of their community and whatnot. They kind of lean into that, and like, he decides like, fuck this, like the government is killing our people. This takes precedence over like whatever else, right? Mm-hmm. And so he decides to like ambush the PMCs, like shooting at the establishment, and they throw in smoke grenades, and they have this action sequence where it's like everything is pure smoke, and like suddenly one thing pops out of the smoke and there's like this bit of violence, and then it disappears back again. It's like really stylized.
Oh, interesting.
It's actually really cool, really done.
Yeah,
well,
sounds cool.
And then in the final segment, they are basically in this like large apartment building, and this group of mercenaries, they're like kicking down every door, like shooting everybody inside, and like moving up floors, right? They're basically like killing everyone in the building. And he, by himself, because he's like the only one left, the main character, he like goes in and like fights against them. And that's like a really cool action sequence. Like, he pulls the fire alarm, so it's like the lights are going on and off constantly.
Cool.
It's like, again, really cool stylized action.
Yeah.
So that was pretty cool. Like, the movie kind of shot above its pay grade and actually kind of nailed it, which was nice. And at the post credits, they actually show a teaser for a TV show coming this fall.
I can see that working as a show, yeah.
Yeah, so it's interesting. So, I mean, if you're into the Purge movies, this is good like the second one and not bad like the third one or mediocre like the first one. So go check it out. And also, like I said, like it's really real. So, yeah.
I watched Ant-Man and the Wasp.
I've been meaning to see that. Is it good?
Yeah, it's good. I mean, it's exactly like the first one. Mm-hmm. It's lighthearted. Paul Rudd is great.
Okay, I need to know one thing. This is like the make or break point for me. Does Michael Peña's character do the storytelling thing?
Yes.
Okay, good.
It's actually a really good scene. They don't play it straight and just give you another scene. They mm-hmm. do that shtick in a really funny and interesting way. So it's exactly like the first one. It's just a nice movie, nice funny movie. I will say a few things that stood out for good and for bad. I won't mm-hmm. spoil anything. The good thing that I noticed just as I was watching this one, but it was also present in the first, they really made sure that the color scheme, as far as the whole dimensional travel goes and like the aesthetics, fits Doctor Strange.
Interesting.
So Doctor Strange and Ant-Man overlap in the comics.
So in the first Doctor Strange movie, I mean, there's only one, but like when he was doing his astral projection stuff, he actually temporarily went into the quantum realm from the Ant-Man.
Exactly. Yeah. So they made sure that they communicate along the same lines. There's another like machine there that helps the villain, and like the energy waves that it brings out really looks like Doctor Strange's magic. So that was a nice touch, and you know, still shows that they're thinking about this as the MCU and how they tie things together. So it was nice to see. The villain was amazing. They did like a feminine version. I mean, you've seen the trailers, I assume.
Yeah, the phasing lady.
Yeah, they did like a female version of Ghost, who's male actually in the comics. Mm-hmm. Really good actress, really good villain, relatable. It was just good, cool powers, cool motives, an actual motive. Michelle Pfeiffer was good. Mm-hmm. And the rest of the stuff you'd expect, like the action was great and the shrinking and all that stuff. The bad stuff, a bit of, it's just on my end, there's comic book fatigue.
How was Evangeline Lilly?
Who does she play?
The Wasp.
Oh, yeah, she plays Hope. She was good. She's not the best actress on the planet, but she's fine. She has good chemistry with Paul, so it worked.
Okay.
It was good. So, you know, the beats were exactly what you'd expect.
Mm-hmm.
Like Marvel quips and quirks, and I'm a bit tired. We spoke about this in chat, right? Whatever. Kind of great. Okay, move on. Lawrence Fishburne, please retire. please retire.
I didn't even know he was in this.
Yeah, he plays like whomever, who cares, like Hank Pym's old colleague.
I think Lawrence Fishburne should retire to just playing roles like he did in John Wick 2.
So that's the thing. He's a good actor, or he used to be a good actor, and now he's just doing all these bullshit roles where he plays the same fucking character, just like what's his face, Whitaker did in Black Panther. Yeah, Forest Whitaker. That he just plays the same role. Ooh, I'm crazy. I'm whatever. and Fishbone is like the same role that he played in Ghost Dog, right? Like the mysterious wise man who is also quirky. Fuck off. Just enough. Enough. So it wasn't a huge point because he doesn't have a lot of screen time, but it's just such a shame seeing him, reduced to this. And then the last thing is the racism. So you have the three dudes who work with the Ant-Man. And in the first movie, they kind of leaned in on the Mexican thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the African-American was also kind of a cliche in the Eastern European. But here, they really stepped on it for some reason. So one, at the end, there's like one of the sleazeball mini-villains. He tells Michael Pena's character, adios, amigos. And he's from the South. He's like a douchebag. But there's no retaliation, right?
Is it Walton Goggins' character?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
He always plays a douchebag, right? So the other character just doesn't do... I mean, he takes him out, right? Spoilers. The bad guys lose.
Wow. Like,
but there's no... There's like no... You know, they don't single it out. They don't work with that, with the fact that, no, you can't fucking say that. But that's the least offense. And then I'm going from least to worst. And the African-American character seems more, even more of a cliche of how African-Americans are portrayed in these movies usually. It's just very egregious and pointless. But the absolute worst is the Eastern European character. So you have Ghost, right? And she can disappear and reappear. And she does, they hear about her, or he sees her, I don't remember. And his thing is Baba Yaga, right? She's like Baba Yaga. So like the only Eastern European belief out there is Baba Yaga, right?
Yeah.
And the way that he says it, it almost feels like he's pressing even harder on his Eastern European accent while he says it. And he keeps going on and on about it. And there's like a point where she freaks him out. He sees her and he starts like whispering a nursery rhyme.
Mm-hmm.
That's very cruel and Stalinist and Soviet and whatever. It's like, it's just so tired and contrived and plastic. It's such a shame because the rest of the movie is fine, but those beats were really hollow and just pointless. I'm not even gonna say offensive because it wasn't like this big part of the movie or grand gesture. It was just like, why be so lazy? So that's it. It's a fine movie. You won't get a masterpiece. Just cool and fun, and that's it.
I watched quick thing. I replayed Wolfenstein: The New Colossus.
Oh yeah,
great game.
Yes,
play it.
No doubt.
I watched a couple of other random things, so I'm just going to give you like a quick rundown. I watched Tao on Netflix, which is like a Netflix original sci-fi-ish, horror-ish movie. Mm-hmm. It was okay. Like, it's pretty low budget and like, whatever. I mean, the premise is that like, this lady gets kidnapped by some like crazy like engineer guy who's trying to build an AI. And mm-hmm. like, he's holding her prisoner in his house. And like she's trying to escape, so whatever. It was not great. I don't heavily recommend it.
Yeah.
I was going to watch the Fahrenheit adaptation by HBO, but I didn't get a chance. It's gotten like really bad reviews, so I really want to see it because it has like Michael B. Jordan and what's the guy who plays General Zod in Man of Steel? Fuck.
Oh yeah.
Michael Shannon, I think.
Yeah.
But instead I watched Atomic Blonde.
Oh yeah, how is it?
It's okay. Like the action is really good. Like Charlize Theron is great, and the movie is like really stylized, like more so than John Wick. Like they really go hard on the like kind of retro wavy, I guess, aesthetic. But yeah. Like the plot was kind of whatever, and James McAvoy was kind of whatever in it. Like he just plays the usual asshole he plays in all the movies.
Yeah.
So I mean, I wouldn't like say go out of your way to watch it, but it wasn't bad. And I watched, I don't know why, the Valco Experiment. So you might have seen the trailer for this, where it's like, basically they put like this office building, suddenly like it gets locked down and they're like, okay, so like kill two of your coworkers or we kill more of you. And they mm-hmm. don't, it's about like, they're like, it doesn't matter how you decide, just kill them, right? And then after that, they're like, okay, now kill 30 of them, right? So it's like this whole social experiment, but horror or whatever.
It's
like,
just a prank, bro.
It was not great. I was bored. I just
doesn't sound good.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there was a chance that it could have been interesting, right? Like, just like the first Purge movie, not the movie titled The First Purge, but the first movie in the Purge series. you know, the cheesy premise that could actually be kind of interesting if done well, but it wasn't done well. So,
yeah. Interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening.
Goodbye.
See ya. Bye. Wrap around.